Parag Hanna, thank you so much for joining Lucas and I here today at Critical Edge.
Such a pleasure. Great to be with you.
Yeah, we're really excited to speak to you. So for our listeners who don't know you, how would you sum up what you're about in, say, 25 words or less? Whistle stop tour of Parag Hanna.
Citizen of everywhere, global citizen, traveler, academic, author, advisor to governments, startup founder of an AI geospatial company.
Brilliant. Thank you.
That might have been exactly 25 words.
Very well played. Great concision. So Parag, you have your finger in a lot of pies. When was the last time you changed your mind in a significant way?
It's a very good question to kick off with. I'm not sure. I think of ideas as evolving, right? Or as, you know, John Maynard Keynes famously said, when the facts change, I change my mind. But he didn't necessarily mean that you're always doing a 180. You know, I'm an informal complex systems theorist, right? And in complex systems, yes, you have nonlinear dynamics, you have emergent properties, you have stochastic kinds of phenomena. It doesn't mean that everything is turning 180 degrees. So I'm not sure that there's, you know, a kind of aha moment where one says, I was wrong, and, you know, now I'm going to be right, and that new position is the somehow permanent new reality. Especially today, I think that approach to the question is probably a more advisable one, rather than just, you know, sort of flip-flopping all the time. It's more, we're all swimming and have to kind of, you know, keep up with the tides.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I feel that sometimes when I take that approach, though, I find myself too hesitant to commit to a position, to go strongly and boldly into a position, because I'm always so inclined to take the other person's perspective. I don't know, you sometimes feel similarly.
Well, I mean, in a management position, like in my own company, you know, it's perhaps it was intuition just from other accumulated experiences, but you operate in a, you know, consensus-oriented way. You're gathering everyone's opinion and they themselves wind up agreeing, and then you ratify, unless you violently disagree with it, the consensus of your team. And that comes from a number of things. You'll see all these, whether it's on social media or in books you'll read about leadership, you know, the person in charge should speak the least. When I started my company, I had to speak the most because I had to explain to people what it is that I actually wanted to do. But now I can actually sit back and speak the least and let others agree, disagree, modify, and come to something that, based on their accumulated expertise, I wind up agreeing with 99% of the time. I very, very, very rarely veto my team.
Okay. Thanks, Parag. So you've made a name for yourself discussing the future of migration and borders. So a hot topic, always been a hot topic, but especially now. What do you make of the discourse concerning immigration in the US and mainland Europe today in 2025?
I mean, there's a global discourse on migration that is ever so steadily evolving from simply de facto believing that people are fine where they are, the system's not broken, you know, to recognizing that you actually have an uncontrolled global mass migration phenomena and no top-down supranational authority that will ever guide us. And so each country is more or less on its own to come up with a strategy that works. And then within that universe of nations that are grappling with emigration and immigration challenges, there are those that have a pragmatic, long-term oriented approach and those that are just flailing. So that's the kind of background context, you know, to your question. So in terms of the US, you know, obviously a lot of flip-flopping in different domains. It's not necessarily helpful to, at that point, speak about migration as one, you know, kind of coherent issue. It's more like, what are we doing with talent? Are we making it easier for them to come in? Are we giving people green cards or citizenship as soon as they graduate from university, as Canada basically does, and people in America talk about doing, but don't necessarily haven't executed? Are we de-bureaucratizing the system and streamlining all of the paperwork and regulation and guidelines? You know how many people sit in what is known as H-1B purgatory, you know, in the United States. States. You're talented. You've come in, you've worked, you've paid taxes. You're more skilled than any local. And yet you still are in this, you know, Kafka-esque nightmare trying to get a, you know, permanent residency. And then you'll obviously, when you raise the question, you may or may not be explicitly referring to asylum seekers and illegal migration on the southern border or elsewhere, which numerically is very, very high, but is not representative of all migration, right? Other than in situations where you have a massive influx of asylum seekers and illegal border crossings, what's known as irregular migration, most migration most of the time is legal. It's family migration, meaning chain migration, or it's skilled migration, it's economic migration, and it's perfectly valid, legitimate, and is, you know, sort of part of human history. So these mass irregular, illegal migrations and asylum seeking, that's the part that's, you know, raising the most controversy. So, you know, I think there's, I shouldn't go on forever, but I mean, every country has a sovereign right to determine its own migration policy. It is a principal vestige of what we still think of when we think of sovereignty, so much of which is eroded. But controlling your own border obviously is part and parcel in a way that's fairly irrefutable. So if a country says, look, there's a border for a reason, we have to know who the people are within this country. Maybe they should even all have identification cards, whether or not, irrespective of what tier they're in. It's kind of hard to deny that that's a perfectly legitimate, you know, claim for a government to be making, right? It's sort of, again, pretty foundational. How they go about doing it could obviously be done in more or less humane ways, you know, separating families, you know, imprisoning in anonymous ways, you know, removing all rights or due process, that kind of thing. Obviously, that's not something that I'm going to endorse. But the situation in the United States, to put things in perspective, had gotten so out of control that when you look at official U.S. migration statistics that come from international agencies, like from the UN, you would have a bar chart, you know, U.S., U.K., Germany, Australia, and so on. For the U.S., you would have a break in the bar chart or line. It's sort of legal migration and then other. And the other was greater than the legal, right? That is not normal. Now, I'm not exactly the kind of person you turn to for a blanket endorsement of the Trump administration. But that said, you're dealing with something so extraordinary that when Washington says, look, we actually do need to figure out who's who, otherwise things will get overwhelming. It's not that America doesn't have the space. Remember in Trump's first term, he said, we're full. That was actually a term in 2017, 2018. You guys might be too young to remember, but it was one of the phrases like, okay, America is not full was actually what all the economists and demographers were retorting, you know, responding to Trump in 2018. Like, no, we're not really full. And of course, we're not literally full. But again, if you look at Germany, you look at Britain, the demographic balance and demographic consensus or democratic consensus in favor of migration will erode if it's not managed well, right? So, and final point is just right now, there's a lot of people, and this is very, very prominent in German politics right now and American politics, is the notion that asylum seeking, you know, or asylum claims are, there's a lot of bogus in there. You know, in the European media, you see reports that 75% of all the vacations that asylum seekers have taken is to their home country, where they are nominally supposed to have been persecuted and would be afraid to return to. So obviously something has to be done about that.
Yeah, so interestingly, I was watching an interview of yours recently. I think the interview was posted about 5 years ago, and you were asked a similar question regarding attitudes to immigration in the West. And you said that actually sort of these hardline attitudes to immigration aren't characteristic of the West. And the example of Canada you just mentioned, you mentioned again, I think citing something like a 1% increase in population growth every year just from immigration, right? Have you noticed a shift in the discourse, and how do you think that's going to impact bigger demographic movement after that?
And there's a huge point in here about the notion of a coherent Western view of anything in particular, and migration in general, or globalization. Let's take the biggest issue of all. People say, you know, the West is, you know, losing faith in globalization or whatever. And I'm like, okay, stop generalizing in this absurdly universalistic kind of way. So I point out that, look, if you look at just migration, you've never had more migrants into Germany, right? I mean, in the last 10 years, Britain, despite Brexit, is bringing in more migrants effectively than ever before, and even you know, loosening some of the strictures around navigating through the system and attaining permanent residency and citizenship. Canada, which you mentioned, growing its population by more than 1 million per year. Australia, obviously remaining a top migration magnet. So around the world, you see plenty of countries where immigration is at record high levels. And not that there's necessarily full support for it, but it's viewed as just a default condition and something that's necessary for their economy, as it is in Canada, as it is in Australia, even in Japan. So the notion that the world is turning inward and the world is anti-globalist and the world is anti-migrant is just simply factually not true. Not only that, leaving aside if we were to hold all nations equal and count them up, you know, in just a numerical way and say, well, 23 countries are more open and 15 countries are less open, stop. Ask yourself, who do you want to be like? Which countries are a role model? If Hungary is expelling migrants, that doesn't mean that Australia or Canada should be expelling migrants. Is Hungary your role model for good governance and attracting talent and innovation and growth? Not exactly, right? So if I were country X behind the veil of ignorance, saying here's a set of countries to choose from, and one of which is increasing its population steadily and growing its economy and becoming more innovative and so on and so forth, versus another, I would probably choose the former, right?
Yeah, and I think, as you recognize, globalization is much more than just migration. It's also about trade, the interconnectivity of industry, the possibility of remaining in contact with people who are far away, sending money and so on and so forth. And I think in a more general sense than just with migration, what we've seen from the US is kind of a increasingly isolationist approach. And as a result, China and other Asian countries are, you've said they have in general, but also recently in response to the tariffs and so on, been forming trade agreements, for example, China and Vietnam more recently. So do you see a turn in what people would call American hegemony? You might disagree with that term, but do you see a turn in America's position in the world?
Well, I mean, it's funny you use the word hegemony. So about 18 years ago, I did a cover for the New York Times magazine, and they had a little squishy kind of jelly shape of America kind of thing squeezed between fingers, two fingers. And the title was Waving Goodbye to Hegemony. So that was an essay I wrote, you know, 7,000-8,000 words 18 years ago. And obviously, I felt that structural dynamics like multipolarity and emerging powers competing for influence and the new trade and diplomatic arrangements among them were weakening America's hegemonic status in the world. And quite frankly, that they already had. So in my mind and in my framework and my analysis, U.S. hegemony has been gone for a very long time. Only the exorbitant privilege of its U.S. dollar reserve status, which we're obviously seeing eroding right now, was a truly decisive area where you could see America more or less dictating global interest rates. Obviously, most countries having most of their trade surpluses recycled into U.S. dollars, their currency reserves and so forth in dollars. That's starting to change and shift and erode. Geopolitically, as someone who was personally involved in the Iraq and Afghanistan wars and so forth, if the definition of hegemony is actually being able to dictate outcomes around the world, and seeing the failure of those two wars, let alone many other foreign policy interventions the last couple of decades, that to me doesn't exactly sound like hegemony either. So I've always been looking at the system from the outside in and bottom-up perspectives, rather than presuming that you have a top-down, rigid, hegemonic order, and then one day it shifts after a war happens, and you're just waiting for that war to happen. Instead, it's, again, a complex system that's always evolving, and that evolution away from hegemony is something that began, quite frankly, 40 or 50 years ago, even before the Cold War ended, and has accelerated since the end of the Cold War. So view these things in a fluid, you know, evolving way, rather than a binary way. And you start to see why I and many other people, quite frankly, well over 20 years ago, were saying, no, this is not a hegemonic order. So what we're seeing today is just symptoms, obviously, of this broader trend, rather than, you know, a kind of T equals zero moment, because everyone likes to say, ah, this is the moment that American hegemony ended. No, this was the turn, because you can go back and read all of those essays and view all those speeches, right? When George W. Bush was elected in the year 2000 in what was a very contested, you know, election from a legal political standpoint, people said, this is it. You know, America has lost credibility. America will never lead again. And then after the Iraq war launched, people said, oh my goodness, America is the Colossus Empire again, dictating affairs around the world and intervening at will. The true structural study of geopolitical power dynamics is not something that is a function of, you know, 2 year, 4 year political cycles, right? It's a much deeper measurement of power and its distribution in the system according to different functional areas, military and diplomatic and economic and so forth. So I tend to take a fairly, you know, non-political with a lowercase p view and a much more macro approach.
Okay. So the movement of American hegemony is not so strict. It's quite fluid. And in a similar way, the movement of people from country to country is also quite fluid. But just based off the kind of research Ollie and I have been doing, we feel that there are still kind of large inequalities within those movements of people. And I mean, like all resources and forms of capital, the distribution isn't equal. So are we kind of seeing an ingraining of inequality here with just this added factor of movement capital?
Well, again, there just is no top-down imposition of an optimal distribution of people around the world. You know, this was the point of departure for my book, Move. I said, we have almost 9 billion people in the world. We have just over 8 billion people in the world today. When we reach peak humanity, around the year 2050, we might have a population of 9.5 or so billion human beings alive simultaneously. Where will they be? And one of my principal arguments from, again, a macro standpoint was we have a great misalignment. There's a misalignment in the geography of natural resources, right? Where are the resources versus where are the people? Where are the borders versus where is the economic activity? Versus where are the people versus where are the resources? So a misalignment of natural geography, political geography, functional geography, and human geography. There is a great distortion. And we have evolved into that, stumbled into that reality, right? As a result of where we have economic activity, where we place borders, and so on and so forth. Rectifying that, one way to rectify that misalignment is by moving people, right? People move to where they're needed, to where there are resources, where there's climate stability, political stability. Those societies may or may not accept them. They may have to move from one place to another, to another, to another. So a constant resorting. I started out thinking that move meant one directional moves for one set of people from A to B. Call it from south to north. By the end, I realized that, well, I should have called it moving, because actually it's a perpetual nomadism in a way of hundreds of millions of people seeking to find their own place in this, you know, evolving demographic landscape. So that's, again, a huge part of the fluidity. So there isn't one answer. There isn't one final map. There isn't one optimal, perfect distribution of people, because demographics is very complex. It's always changing. People are needed in some places and then needed somewhere else, and so on and so forth. So for me, one of the fascinating things has been looking at diasporas. I'll give you an example. So, you know, the Indian diaspora, my own, I myself was born in India, migrated via the Middle East to the United States with my family. And you would now see Indian Americans being very entrenched. But I went to high school in Germany, where I was the only ethnically Indian person within, you know, call it 250 kilometers radius, right? And but over the last 35 years that I've been traveling in and out of Germany, I've now noticed that there's, you know, literally hundreds of thousands of Indians in Germany. According to the last count, about 550,000 Indians live in Germany. And so what happens is that within a single generation, migration begets more migration, because, as I was saying before, most migration is chain migration, people following their family. So if before you would say, why would any Indian ever go to Germany? 5 years later, the reason is, oh, because I've got a cousin there. And then you've suddenly got 1,000 cousins there. And suddenly you've got a whole towns and villages full of Indians there. And so that's how these things evolve over time. So where you thought there was nothing, there is eventually something and then a lot. And that happens on a planetary scale much faster than we realize.
Right. Would you agree that the higher your ability to move, so the stronger your passport, the more privilege you have in the world? So those kind of from countries that don't have that ability with weaker passports actually face some sort of global inequality.
Of course, that is true. But I would also break it down by age. So I want to make a fundamental point, because you're obviously right about passport apartheid, right, in a way. But it was ever thus to some degree, although unless you're talking about involuntary movements, because during the British Empire, literally tens of millions of people were forcibly relocated between South Asia, East Africa, Southeast Asia, and the Caribbean, right? So to be clear, you know, that's not what you're talking about right now. Right now you're saying that
voluntary, more voluntary.
Most human beings will never leave the country in which they were born. For economic or other reasons, they are stuck in place. Most Egyptians will never leave Egypt. Most Indians will never leave India. Most Brazilians will never leave Brazil. Most Nigerians will never leave Nigeria. Many of those countries, you know, roughly more than 150 out of 200 countries, don't have very powerful passports. Whether young or old, rich or poor, they can't just get up and get on a plane and go wherever they want. So yes, there is this entrenched structural inequality of access to the privilege of migration. That said, I want to not necessarily flip things on its head, because that is true and that is lamentable. But you are young people and you have a young audience. And I want to remind everyone that there has never been a better time in the history of the world to be a young person who, A, has skills, some skill that is needed somewhere in the world, if not where you are physically, then somewhere else. And to be mobile, like the capacity to relocate. You don't have to take care of elderly. You don't have a job you have to maintain where you are. So if you have a skill and if you are mobile, then even with the worst passport in the world today, you can probably get accepted to go somewhere. You don't have a criminal record. You have some technical or vocational capability or skill. You know, you can go online and fill out a digital form on your mobile, perhaps for the Canadian government or some other country, and you are going to get access to that country, right? There's a good shot that's going to happen. So yes, we could speak purely numerically, blindly about the human population and say, oh my God, it's tragic that 5 billion people are stuck in place and may never leave. But if you focus on the youth demographic that is most likely to want to go somewhere and has the physical capability to go somewhere, and if they have some skill, it might be the best time in world history, right? Because you can digitally apply, just go, right? And you will be wanted somewhere. There's this country that needs you and wants you. And I think that's a pretty powerful statement. So I myself, again, ethically am as, torn up about, like you are, about the macro state of affairs, the initial conditions, as you might say. But I also see the flip side of opportunity, given the demographic imbalances in the world and need for young people to stimulate economies. And that's why you have 100 countries with nomad visa, digital visa, e-visa, you know, kinds of programs today.
There's a lot I agree with that. The one distinction I'd make, perhaps, or contradistinction from what you said, is you said it's not purely numerical. And I think you were referring back to what Lucas said about passport inequality and the fact that some people don't move as some other people, and other forms of inequality are present as well. I want to read you a quote from one of the interviews I read recently, which I think will be informative here, kind of in a more general way about this sort of inequality. You say, and I quote, "History is a set of layers of soil and sediment enriching and fertilizing each other." Now, the reason that I say I think it's more than just purely numerical and that it's structural is, to some extent, I disagree with that, right? I think the history of colonialism is not a history of fertilization and cross-contamination, but really a history of, to carry on the metaphor before we take it too far, taking people's soil. And I think a lot of relations that are set up now, that passport inequality and so on and so forth, inequality of movement, inequality of access to resource, control to resource in certain countries as well. A lot of this is structural. A lot of this is a heritage of power relations which have come before. India is growing at a huge rate as well, but the historic poverty of India with regards to the West is also an impact of colonialism and the state that the UK left the country in 1947. So do you see that there might be sort of not just a flux, but more wider structural issues which encase and preserve these sorts of relations?
So, I mean, the extractive nature of colonialism is very well documented and doesn't have to be, you know, sort of relitigated here. Nothing about it.
My claim is more so that those sorts of relations have set up an imbalance in power structures with regards to economic and other relations today, rather than, I think we're all aware that colonialism was extractive, right?
Sure, but 2025 is not 1945, right, to be clear. So we have 80 years now of post-colonial history for most of the planet Earth. Most of the people of the world, the citizens of the world, the nations of the world are post-colonial states. Most of them have had roughly 80 years to figure out what comes next. They've inherited structural inequalities, poverty, you know, exploitative relationships, and so forth. But when you look at the post-colonial world, you can't explain the year 2025 and the state of affairs across this entire swath of humanity. Again, most of humanity is what we're talking about right now, right? You can't explain where they are or are not, what they have or have not achieved in the past 80 years, only with reference to the inherited legacy, the advantages and disadvantages, primarily the latter, of the colonial legacy, right? So you have to look at everything in between. Now, within that, you would say, now, which countries have made it and which countries haven't? This happens to be a topic I've written an awful lot about, which is to say, you take regions of the world that are post-colonial. You can take Africa as a whole, or East Africa in particular. You can look at Southeast Asia, where I happen to live. You can look at Latin America, and you could say, what are the characteristics? The Arab world, obviously, as well. What are the characteristics of those post-colonial regions or sub-regions or countries where they've succeeded versus not? Now, I happen to live in Singapore, which is, by a very wide margin, the most successful post-colonial country of the entire lot. So much so that it is unimpeachably, well, you know, probably the most successful, stable, well-functioning country on the planet, post-colonial or not. So, you know, when you look at this country, what you see in terms of the attitude, let's just talk for a moment about psychology, right? A place that said, love it or hate it, you know, good or for ill, we are now on our own, and we're going to make the best of what we have, right? What we have today and what we inherited from yesterday, and we're going to move on. And you don't see a society that complains about the negative dimensions of colonialism, you know, the exploitation, whatever the case may be. Then you take, on the other end of the spectrum, you know, countries in the Middle East, you know, Arab countries that are still blaming the British, that are still blaming Israel, whatever the case may be, for all of their woes. And then you see what their state of affairs is. So if you're not willing to talk about corruption, if you're not willing to talk about poor governance, if you're not willing to talk about lack of a vision, if you're not willing to talk about economic strategy and public policy and infrastructure investment and education, and all of those things that some countries have not done, even though they should have, could have done it over the past 80 years, you're not going to come to a fruitful answer to explain why some countries are still so underprivileged and underperforming today. Again, with all of the blame that one can allocate to the colonialism, the legacies thereof, there comes a point, and I would say the last 80 years would be that point, we say, well, what else can we use to explain this? And when we talk about these situations, and we don't talk about corruption, we don't talk about poor governance, we're kind of missing the picture. And again, I say this as someone who's born in a post-colonial country, whose entire family, so India, my father is literally a refugee from the partition. He was born in Lahore and then fled to India, you know, still has scars, you know, from that experience. I can, you know, sort of revile everything about colonialism and still say, if I were the president of country X in Africa or the Middle East or Asia, circa 1950s, what should I have done to bootstrap my nation? And did I do those things or not do those things? So we've got to be really honest and you know, holistic in our understanding of the situation.
Yeah, I think you're definitely right to be precise and give different analyses country by country. Singapore has done amazingly well. China has obviously had unbelievable economic growth since the 70s, 80s. India is also a super rapidly growing economy. Applying that sort of precision, I think post-colonial relations look quite different for a lot of countries, and this is why I don't want to, as well as explanations regarding corruption and so on, which is why I don't want to speak generally. But to take the example of something like the Congo, you mentioned resources before, right? Congo, the Democratic Republic of Congo, whatever may be going on in that country, has lithium, quite literally the most perhaps valuable mineral in the world, right? It's the mineral required for all technology. And yet the Democratic Republic of the Congo is still in the top five poorest countries in the world. And 75% of the population lives on less than $2.15 a day. So do you see how these post-colonial relations might look different for different countries, and that corruption and poor governance simply can't explain everything that's going on there? As one example amongst many.
Yeah. So again, every country absorbs the phases or chapters of history, you know, differently. You have a post-colonial, immediate post-colonial chapter of strongman nationalism and settlement of borders and consolidation of power within countries. You have the phase of developing a new sovereign dynamic in relations with your neighbors and with your former colonial powers. And each of these chapters and episodes can be handled well or not well. You have a phase of mass population growth and stress on infrastructure and public services to the extent they exist at all. You have a phase where you need to be training your own civil service and bureaucracy and developing your formal institutions. You have a phase in which you are connecting to regional and the global economy in terms of what resources you have, whether it's agriculture or minerals, you know, becoming part of global supply chains. Each of these things is happening sequentially and simultaneously over the last decades. Congo is a country that's not handled any of those, you know, phases or chapters well at all, not to mention obviously brutal civil war, genocidal civil war, war with neighbors, a high degree of corruption, inability to generate a value added, you know, sort of set of industries around its mineral ecosystem, and all of these kinds of things. It's not the only country that's in that situation, to be clear. So I'm not, you know, again, the more you look at all of those issues together, the less you would be monocausal about what explains the ills of Congo. So it's everything you've said, and it's everything I've said, and it's a lot more things that we don't have time for. That's the way I view every single place in the world, is I want to turn over every single stone and figure out what caused something rather than blame any one thing or attribute success to any one thing. You know, when people look at Singapore, everyone loves to say Lee Kuan Yew as if that makes them sound super educated. That's not a particularly educated understanding of what explains Singapore. Yes, you had the man, but look at the institutions he built. And it may be really boring to talk about institutions, but how could you look at the country today and not see the importance of institutions rather than only Lee Kuan Yew and view the two in tandem? And that would be just one set of observations about this country. Again, when it comes to a country on the other end of the spectrum like Congo, it's many, many things that have not gone right. A lot of decisions could have been made differently, right, is the point. And a lot of decisions haven't and still continue to not be made well in countries like that. And so you wind up where they are, right? And they wind up where they are. And it's especially tragic because, again, in a complex system, in an unpredictable world, you wind up with things like COVID, right, and trade wars and other kinds of phenomena that really do further isolate and impoverish countries inadvertently, and it simply sets them back even more. And so one of the things I talk about in the Move book is really about this sort of geographical arbitrage, you know, winning and losing geographies. This is a pretty core element, quite frankly, of geopolitical theory going back to the 19th century. It's sort of what is a scientific demarcation of the world according to what its role is in a global functional division of labor. There's a whole Marxist variant, obviously, around that, but just focusing on the degree of their interpenetration and the extent to which globalization helps to uplift them or merely, you know, sets them further back through exploitation. It's you're treading water, right? And you're trying to stay above water and get your body out of the water. And a lot of countries have failed to do that, and things are only getting more difficult for them.
Thank you. While we're kind of focusing and pinpointing on certain countries, which I think is really helpful, I wanted to kind of draw our attention to Germany for a moment, which I think is a really interesting one. I know that you are a fan of Merkel, have been a fan. And, you know, she has the famous Wandel durch Handel motto, right? Which, for those who don't know, is kind of building relationships and maybe like soft power ties with other countries through economic trade. And, you know, she bet on Russian gas, believing that, you know, that economic integration would bring peace, which, you know, that theory to some extent collapsed in 2022, at least for Germany, with the Russian invasion of Ukraine. I was wondering how that specific event, how relevant do you think that is to the larger kind of globalization movement and the larger, your larger understanding of countries' cooperation with each other?
So, I mean, you have to go back a little bit further. I mean, there's a variant of neoliberalism, a variant of democratic peace theory and other intellectual strains that have come together. And even if those ideas and theories didn't exist, you would still have the dilemma of the 1980s, which is China is a fast-growing economy. How do we integrate it formally into the global trading system through its entry into the WTO? And would trade transform the society towards in a democratic direction? So modernization theory, these kinds of questions that at the time you would say, look, better to engage than not to engage, right? You cannot influence a country merely by seeking to isolate it, especially when you actually are consuming its resources, so you're not isolating it. And that's the dilemma that you have with Russia with respect to energy or with China with respect to its labor force and manufacturing capacity. So as a default, our position as, you know, the diplomatic system and the economic system is to try to integrate as much as possible, right? And that's what has been happening since the 1970s, 80s, and 90s. Wandel durch Handel is basically like a subset of that, which is in some ways a mischaracterization because it isn't in fact trade that actually changes the political characteristics of a regime. If anything does, it's investment more than trade. So, and this is well documented in political science. So in studies of whether a country's regulations and laws have changed, they don't tend to change simply because a country is trading. They only change if you have a huge amount of foreign investment and the foreign investors are able to rewrite laws on a national scale. Things like labor rights or environmental rights and legal protections for intellectual property and so on and so forth. So Wandel durch Handel was always somewhat of a simplified mischaracterization. What incentive would Germany have to simply cut off ties with Russia in the 1990s and 2000s when Putin came to power and actually in his first couple of years sought to continue Yeltsin's policies of engagement with the West, even though he was very upset by the bombing of Kosovo and bombing of Serbia in defense of Kosovo and other kinds of tensions. And obviously you had then the invasion of Georgia, and we all know the rest, you know, starting in the mid to late 2000s, tensions spike. But would you at that point say, and would we be better off today in a counterfactual to say, oh, we should have simply, because of Putin's invasion of Georgia in 2008 during the Beijing Olympic Games, we should simply have just frozen out Russia and cut off its oil imports? What would that have done to Russia? Would Russia have collapsed at a period of high commodities prices? No. Would you have changed the character of the Russian regime? No. So I think that one has to look within the broader reality of interpenetration and some degree of economic codependence of economies to look for levers of change, or to simply accept, because it was naive in the 80s, 90s, and 2000s to ever actually think that China would suddenly be a different type of regime than the one-party state that it is. Now, I never thought, and just because some people did, I think perhaps, I don't know whether how I would quantify majority minority on this, but as someone who started traveling extensively in China in the 2000s and wrote a book on Chinese, you know, grand strategy, I was never under any illusion that a lot of trade with China would mean that China would suddenly become democratic. I think that was ludicrous, right, to begin with. And I don't think that Russia is necessarily going to have a different kind of political system than it has right now. So I think there's theory and reality, you know, and in reality, we are fated to need to you know, engage with these countries. My thesis, I wrote an essay about this recently, is saying that we should continue to have connectivity-focused strategies with these societies, right? Not just the regime, but the people. You should let people flow outward. The best way to weaken an enemy regime or a foe is to brain drain its talent pool, right? As the US, as the West has done, actually, with respect to Russia, gradually over time in phases and episodes. Don't punish the people is, you know, almost rule number one. And anyway, there's other, you know, tactics and strategies we would use. But I would say, again, sovereigntist nations like China and Russia aren't going to change simply because they're receiving more or less trade or investment from other countries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's very easy, certainly from the perspective of the media, to focus perhaps too much strictly just on armed conflict and how that influences relations. I think another factor might be, to some extent, perhaps a bias in popular international relations theory, but also international relations theory in general. And a specific example I can think of is, speaking of world powers throughout history as either being unipolar, bipolar, tripolar, multipolar, whatever stage of history and however you want to conceive of it, implicitly that kind of categorization sees things or sees powers in opposition, not in connectivity or collaboration, like you might call it.
Well, certainly not collaboration, but, you know, basically, again, geopolitical orders evolve over long time periods. So for me, it's been fairly clear for 20 years, and I don't lose any sleep at night over this, that again, I don't expect to wake up to a fundamentally different structure of power in the world than what I already wrote about 20 years ago, which is to say that the world is multipolar and multipolar on a global scale. So previous multipolar orders obviously were within the European imperial or Western imperial context. Now you have a globally distributed multipolarity where China is a superpower, European Union, United States, and other, you know, secondary powers. Within that global multipolarity, you have multipolarity within Asia itself. Of course, China is prima inter pares, right? First among equals. But Japan, India, Australia, these are great powers, middle powers, regional powers, whatever the case may be. So you have a multipolar region of Asia in a multipolar world. That, to me, is an accurate statement about power distribution. And again, to me, it's kind of been that way for quite a long time. I mean, like, since I was your age, it's been that way. So yes, it's evolving. Percentages of, you know, power here and there in economic terms and military terms and all of these kinds of things. But roughly speaking, that's where we are. And that's where we're going to be for quite a while. So for people to kind of just, you know, issue grand proclamations like, oh, it's still a unipolar world and it's in slow and gradual transition, my question back is always, when will you acknowledge that the world has ever actually arrived at multipolarity? If for you, it's always still a unipolar order that will eventually become multipolar, right? Who am I waiting for? Who is China waiting for to anoint them a superpower, is another way of putting it, right? Does it have to be The Economist magazine who decides, right? Because I tend to think they're a decade or two behind the curve. They generally are. As far as I'm concerned, we're already there.
With regards to this multipolarity, Parag, and this is not something that we spoke about a lot during this interview, but climate change is one of the main topics you discuss in your writings. How do you see climate change and migration developing hand in hand in the next kind of 10, 15, 20 years?
I mean, we can start with just climate in the sense that, you know, physical climate hazards, flooding, storms, heat waves, droughts, sea level rise, wildfires, all of that are definitely resorting geography in its most fundamental sense into livable and unlivable areas for the world population. Our capacity to survive physically in geographies is being dictated by these very rapidly shifting climate dynamics as temperatures rise and you have these, you know, chain reactions and hothouse effects. You know, you can survive in a hot place with air conditioning, but you cannot survive without water, right? So the world is being divided into places literally that have water or don't have water. Or if they don't have water, can they afford desalination or not? Otherwise, literally, you know, people can't survive one day. I have, you know, I sort of developed this concept, which is a legal term, you might even say vacant states, right? There will be in our lifetimes, states that are vacated because of climate change. Literally no human being will live there anymore. And therefore it will no longer meet the definition of what a state is, which is to say recognized borders and a set fixed human population. So they will simply be up for grabs to the global supply chains for whatever resources they have that are useful, right? I even say in the book that we might bury nuclear waste in these countries because there'll be no one to object to it, right? That's the kind of resorting that's going on. Migration and mass migration, accelerated mass migrations, are a function partially of that climate dynamic. If you to look at the countries in the world that are the most climate stressed and overlay the demographics, you would come to a very morally repugnant picture, which is that most of the world's young people, people your age, are trapped in countries that are becoming ever more climate stressed. And that's what I'm referring to when I speak about this grand misalignment. So you will have a resorting of the human population due to everything from geopolitics to demographics to climate change, right? And people will be stressing those borders and relocating into more climate adapted, climate resilient areas. And I've identified what those geographies are, and very few of them are actually ready, you know, politically or infrastructurally, to be on the receiving end of mass migrations. Some places are, others are not. You know, Canada can take its fair share, right, and will sort of figure it out. United States, again, has, it's not full, it has space, but it's not politically ready. I've written about places like Eastern Turkey in particular, so the Eastern Anatolian sort of region, where you have, it borders to the south on Iraq, Iran, Syria, some young, stressed, climate-stressed countries where you'll have a mass exodus of people due to, again, domestic politics and climate, and they will push northward into eastern Turkey. And Turkey is already home to more refugees than any other country in the world, right? And it could be tens of millions more, inevitably. So that's the way I'm viewing, you know, climate change and migration in tandem, as reshaping politics and not nullifying borders, but certainly transcending them in very obvious ways.
Yeah, so your analysis, I suppose, lies on climate change in relation to migration, insofar as climate change is something that's happening, something that's difficult to solve as a problem globally due to different interests, winners and losers. To talk about climate change in and of itself, what does a global organization look like? And when I say organization, I mean globally organizing, not an organization. What does global organizing look like to combat climate change, and not just to think about what we're going to do as things develop?
Right. So on the one hand, you want to give credit where credit is due. It's very common to denigrate United Nations and other multilateral organizations. But if you go back to the Stockholm, you know, climate summit of 1972 and other research that was done at the time, you had multilateral bodies research driven point to and highlight the perils of climate change way before it was mainstream. But that said, 50 years later, you haven't seen them capable of effective global environmental governance, right? In a way that is, you know, imposing global norms and codes of conduct on states. We've had 28 or 29 COP summits, one loses count. And other than the performative act of trying to get countries to sign pledges to meet the Paris climate emissions targets, we've blown through them. So we're not achieving anything diplomatically that isn't better achieved technologically. And all of the money that is spent on climate summits, I believe, should be redirected towards technological interventions that will either reduce emissions through, obviously, the energy transition, or contain carbon emissions, you know, even reverse them by carbon sequestration and other kinds of geoengineering kinds of themes or ideas, or into climate adaptation, right? Helping societies adapt through, again, relocating populations, doing water desalination, drought-resistant seeds for their crops and farming and so on and so on and so on. So that's where I would put the money, every penny of it, into mitigation and adaptation. And that's what a multilateral body at a global scale could facilitate or help to coordinate. Again, it's going to happen anyway through investments in technology, through market forces, but regional development banks, multilateral institutions, the World Bank could all accelerate that process. And they are doing a bit, but they're not doing nearly enough. So I would put way more resources into adaptation toolkits and mitigation technologies and distribute them as rapidly as possible all over the planet. And that's not what we're seeing happening today. What we're seeing is specific countries doing it, like China, but China is not doing it, you know, doing its energy transition simply because the United Nations said it would be a good idea, right? It's in their strategic and commercial interest to do so. It diminishes their dependency on fossil fuel imports. It reduces their own, pollution domestically. And it stimulated a massive export industry, which they dominate on a global scale, right? So China didn't need the United Nations to tell them to do it. So I don't believe that centralized organizations are needed anymore in this domain, at least not, they're not as important. And I wouldn't abolish them, but they're not nearly as important as what's happening in the technological domain, in the domestic policy domain, in the commercial domain.
Thank you, Parag. And while I may push back on the kind of soft power that China gains by aligning with UN's policies, I think we have to bring this interview to a close. Unfortunately, it's been really, really great to talk to you. I was wondering if you had any kind of closing thoughts, both for Ollie and I, and also for our audience who are listening or watching.
Be mobile. You never know where you're going to go next. And honestly, it's something I get asked a lot after the last book is, you know, what's your advice for young people? I centered the protagonists of that book were global youth, which is why earlier when we were talking, I really wanted to make that point about it's, you know, there's really never been a better time in history to be a young, skilled, mobile person. And that is your demographic. So as much cynicism and pessimism as one can rightly have about the state of affairs in the world today, a lot of things could be and should be better than they are, which is unfortunate. But I still think that you yourselves and your demographic and your audience, being who you are, can be real change makers if you take advantage of your skills and are willing to get up and go to where those skills are needed and roll up your sleeves. So that's, you know, kind of hopefully an optimistic and encouraging note to end on.
Yeah, well, on that very encouraging note, we'll end it there. Thank you for joining us, Parag. This was Critical Edge with Parag Khanna.